Hello and welcome to iPod, the College of Optometrists podcast, where we explore the profession and the fascinating world of vision and eye care, discover new ideas and research, and learn from others' experiences. I'm Denise Voon, Clinical Advisor to the College, and I'm really excited to introduce Nazia Fitzpatrick, who's a business psychologist, executive coach and facilitator, and has worked, amongst other places, for the Ministry of Defence and the NHS. Hello, Nazia, and welcome to iPod.
Hi Denise, nice to speak to you, and what a lovely intro.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I haven't done you any justice whatsoever, because looking through your bio, you've done so much for so many different organisations in terms of team building and culture and EDI. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you about some actually quite worrying statistics from the General Optical Council's Registrant Workforce and Perception Survey.
Yeah, absolutely. I've worked in a lot of different industry sectors, in talent management, inclusion, lots of different areas, but I have also loved and worked with staff surveys and data. And yeah, it's a very worrying data point that we're talking about today, for sure.
Yeah, and if our listeners haven't read it yet, it is available on the GOC website, but the most concerning, I suppose, is that of all the registrants who did reply, 41% said that they had experienced bullying and harassment from patients, service users, relatives, or the public. And that's compared to 28% in the NHS in general. 18% of our registrant had, again, experienced bullying and harassment from a manager, and that's compared to 11%. And 16% had from a colleague, compared to 19%. And I guess what's even more concerning is that only 29% of those actually reported it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking at those stats and looking at them in comparison to the NHS, there's some real differences there. The one that I find of note is the difference from the patient experience. The NHS being at 28% in terms of experiencing discrimination from patients, whereas for you guys, it's 41%. That's quite a jump. But then also for the managers as well, the difference in experience there, that again, that there's a big jump there. What I want to do here is just take a little step back and talk about the registrant survey itself. This is about their experience of how they're experiencing the world of work. So when they step in, quite a huge proportion, so 41%, that's almost half of your colleagues, are experiencing some sort of discrimination from service users, from relatives, from the public. That's quite a stark statistic. And then when you look at that and you look at it from a manager's perspective, that's, is it 18%? 18% are saying that they're experiencing this from their managers. Now, a manager is there to support you. A manager is there to help you, to bring the best out of you. So to be in a position where you're experiencing that from your manager, it's got to take you to a pretty dark experience of work. And I suppose if it's okay, Denise, I just wanted to share an experience for myself. Which is after, not long after I left the NHS, I entered an organisation that was really quite, I would probably say quite toxic in its culture. It wasn't a very safe place to be. But what I noticed about myself was it drew the worst out of me. In that environment, I became, I would probably say, quite obnoxious. I became quite manipulative in that I would talk about people behind their back because they were being so, to me, so mean. And actually, it drew this really, really negative, poor behaviour from me. And it's only since I've left that environment that I've really realised how what a dark place I was in. So what I would say here is that I imagine for a lot of these individuals that they don't look forward to going to work on a Monday.
No, and I completely agree. And just sort of listening to your experiences there of when you haven't enjoyed work and you're in an environment that you're just not happy with. I mean, from an optometrist point of view, if you are not happy going to work, if you are dreading seeing the patients, you can't give yourself your best self to them.
Absolutely. And that absolutely plays out in the NHS as well. And in fact, I say in any public sector service oriented environment, if you step into work feeling all those I'd say negative emotions, feeling anxious, feeling worried, feeling all of that, you're actually having to manage a lot about yourself in the space that when you are faced with a patient, that you haven't got the energy, you haven't got it in you to give the best to the patient. And so actually we know that if you work in a challenging environment, a toxic culture, and you're not engaged in your work, you're not feeling part of it, that it results in a lower quality of care to the patient. But what I will also say there is a bit of a sort of cycle in that if you're not bringing your best, your patient's not experiencing the best care. And so they're likely to probably respond in quite a negative way. So you're stuck in this vicious cycle of kind of poor behaviours really from all parties.
Yeah, and just listening to you talking and thinking about how I very much doubt any of our listeners would have gone into optometry not wanting to give the absolute best for every single patient that walks through the door. But when you're in an environment that you're not happy with, and yes, I think we can all say we've been there, you just don't have the energy to treat your patient as well as you feel you should.
That is absolutely it. And especially when you think about professions like optometry and you think about any healthcare profession, the reason that you go into it is a very values driven, from a very values driven place. You want to give good care, you want to support and enable your patients. So to be in an environment that isn't supporting you in doing that, yeah, it's going to draw a lot more from you, 100%.
Yeah, and it certainly isn't sort of any individual's responsibility. It is a collective responsibility from the employers, from the businesses, from the individuals and patients, in really coming together to make this better. I mean, what advice would you give, to businesses when you're feeling that, your staff aren't that well motivated? We know that the sick pay costs the NHS £1 billion every year, which isn't necessarily transferable to optometry. But when you don't have the staff that are coming to work, then you're understaffed, and then it's harder for everybody else. And this cycle that you talk about just perpetuates.
Absolutely. And I think I should caveat everything that I'm saying here with that I'm not an employee relations expert. Where my expertise comes in is definitely within organizational culture change and enabling, I would say, enabling individuals, teams, and organizations to be the absolute best version of themselves. So if you are a leader listening to this and you're thinking, have I got the right environment for my people to thrive? I would probably say the best check for you is if you do most of the talking, if you do most of the ideas generation, if you end up where people just don't share their feedback, and if you don't get feedback, then actually you're probably not in the best place. So my suggestion for you would be that you want to build an environment where it's safe for people to be candid, where it's safe for people to speak up. So there's three things that I would say absolutely do. One is start by getting more feedback. So actually going out and asking your people for feedback. And the real key bit here is to listen to it. Listen to understand. There's no need to respond in that moment, but do draw it and take the meaning from the feedback that you're getting. I would say that it's very important that you give feedback as well. And in this scenario, especially I would say for all these individuals that are experiencing a not a great place to work, I often liken this to a bad apple in a barrel. If you've got one bad apple in a barrel, the whole barrel is spoiled. So if you have an individual that you know is difficult, but they've been there for a long time, but you know they're difficult, they kind of just, that's who they are, that's going to spoil the experience for everyone around them. So I would say there's something about giving real and honest feedback to people, and not worrying too much about not worrying about people's upsetting people, but being really honest with your feedback. And then the third one for me is actually paying attention to how people hear the feedback, their reaction. And this is why leadership is so difficult, because feedback will land in one way to one individual and differently to another. So you've got to be really in tune with the people around you so that it's landing well and that they're able to take something forward. It's quite nuanced, but I definitely say it's building that environment where people are safe to speak up, you're listening to your staff, and you're not the only one doing all of the talking.
Yeah, that is so true. That is exactly right, I think. But as an individual, sometimes I worry that if you've had a bad experience from patient or colleague or your manager, how to have those conversations. I mean, if somebody came in and said something that was met the legal definition of harassment, if they went after someone's characteristic or something like that, I think that's pretty easy to describe it, and it probably would then be fairly easy to deal with. But can you talk to us a little bit about how's the best way to manage the mini microaggressions that you get, the little comments you get all the time, that when you talk about them as examples, they just sound ridiculous. But over time, it can be cumulative, and that culture of cumulative incivility can actually make it very difficult for an employee.
Absolutely. There's two angles that I want to look at this, Denise, as we move forward. The first angle is that what we're going to talk about now is really how an individual builds the mental toughness, I would say, to take action and take back control, because I would imagine that they're feeling a little bit out of control and helpless because of all of the experiences that they're having. So I'm definitely going to take this conversation down the road of taking back control. Covert comments that you make, that is the most dangerous, where it's a bit of banter, or it's, you know, there's tiny little comments that you make over and over again that they are really damaging. They're like weathering. So for me, they're like, you know, when you walk over the same bit of carpet over and over again, eventually it wears it away. That's what's happening to the individual. What I would say to those individuals is absolutely get support. Whether you're getting support via your central HR function, whether you're getting support from colleagues, friends, I believe there is a general support line yourself that you've got, Denise, is that right?
Yes, so the General Optical Council do actually have a speaking up policy and a speaking up document, which you can find on their website, which details who you can contact and how. And what is particularly interesting about their speaking up is when they're sort of encouraging you to speak up, they say that it is for anything that gets in the way of providing patient care or that affects your working life, which includes behaviours of others, which you feel is having an impact on the well-being of you, the people you work with, or a patient.
That absolutely is fantastic that you have that. And I would absolutely recommend to any individual that is experiencing regular micro incivilities, any sort of discrimination, anything which makes them feel like they can't be their authentic self at work, or anything that makes them feel like they don't want to go into work because an individual is going to be there, they absolutely need to contact that number and speak up. 100% need to speak up about it. So my first really is to say that wherever you are, whether you've experienced one incident or you're experiencing several, it is going to have an impact on yourself, on your confidence, and on the amount of control you feel. So speak out, speak up, get support, and really, really start to think about what you want to do. But the second piece that I would say is the how you share your feedback, because I would imagine, if I share back to my own experience, it's hugely emotive. My emotions can sometimes take over when I want to share what's going on. And you're probably going to find that you might get a bit teary. You might feel like you can't share it. So I've got a nice little model that I think is really important when it comes to sharing feedback. And it's called the SBI model. And I've added an A at the end. So the SBI model is where you share feedback or share your experience. You talk about the situation. So what was the situation that this happened in? What was the B, the behavior that you saw? And the I is what was the impact on self, the impact on the project, the impact on the patient? What was the impact? And the A for me is what is the action? What is the thing that needs to shift? What needs to happen next time that is different from this time? And in that model, you can use that model anywhere, but when you're speaking up to, you're contacting the central line, absolutely use that model. When you're sharing it with a peer, absolutely use that model because it will give a really rounded, detailed picture of what's going on and the impact that it's having on you.
Right, so it would be very much, for instance, in your model, the situation sort of I was speaking with a patient or trying to take a patient through. They made a comment about my ethnicity, a negative comment about my ethnicity, and it just made me feel quite devalued. And I lost a lot of confidence from it. And you would like, in this sort of situation, your manager to somehow put process in place where they can protect you from this sort of thing happening again.
That's a really, really good example there, Denise. Absolutely. And what that does is it sparks a conversation. So let's say that this individual, that let's play that example through, is sharing this experience with their manager. Well, the manager absolutely now understands what happened, when it happened, and what the impact was on self, and as they and what the action is this individual wants. And they can together then decide what the best way forward is. What policy do we put in place? Do we need to put a policy in place? What happens? What do you do if this happens again? What impact has it had on you right now? And what can we do to support you? Yeah, so it can be a real partnership and it can lead to some really good outcomes. So yes, that's exactly what I would say we do.
Yeah, because I think it would be really easy in that situation to be actually quite negative about the patient. Like, oh, can you believe it? This patient said this to me. How awful are they? We must never see them again. And kind of go down a very emotive line and really even start hypothesizing about that patient's intent or where they came from or their beliefs, which actually we don't actually know.
What this model does is it gives you a framework to share the experience. It doesn't take the emotion out of it because in the impact, you can absolutely share the emotion that you experienced and the impact that it had on you and how you felt. But what it takes it away from is the potential judgment of the other individual. Now, we don't know everybody's lived experience. We don't know what individuals have been taught as they grow up. What we can share is that empathy and that compassion to people around us. And for that individual, if we had approached this with, well, I can't believe they're just sexist, they're just racist, they were awful, that was horrific. We're not getting to the root here. We're not getting to the problem, which is that the impact of what has happened has meant that I don't want to come into work, that I don't want to deal with a patient again. And that for me is what this model does, is actually it talks through and creates, it enables the individual to start seeing action. What I do want to say, however, is that any sort of overt, covert, racist, sexist, any of that behavior is not acceptable in the workplace. And so that's what I do want to just caveat all of what I've just said, that is, it is not acceptable in the workplace, whether it's from a patient, whether it's from a colleague, it is completely not acceptable. What this model does is enable you to raise it and have a dialogue about it.
Yes, because I think managers or employees might know this isn't right, but it's actually then what are we going to do about it? That's almost the most important bit.
Absolutely. And when you're trying to build that culture where people speak up, then this is exactly what you need to start talking about, is all of those negative behaviors that are causing harm to your people.
And then again, as we talked about, if the employee isn't 100% happy, or their well-being is being affected, then this is going to impact their patient care and possibly patient safety going forward, which is not what we want.
Absolutely. I think we can pretty be pretty confident that it will affect patient safety. I think we can put a direct link there. And I think as well, it's really important to note that if you don't create the culture where people are able to speak up in all parts of your organization, then what is likely to happen is that an individual is not going to share their experience with you. What they're going to do is they are going to have experienced it and be take it away with them, and it's going to sit with them. They're going to ruminate on it, and it's going to have a negative impact on them. And that's why it's so important as leaders in an organization to create a space where people can share those experiences and speak up.
Absolutely. And I guess that what on the other side of it is how do we know when, say, an employee is just being a little bit sensitive? And you mentioned building up their resilience. I've had some experience with resilience training, and what I don't fully understand is that you're just putting so much responsibility on the individual to just get tougher, to just get to be able to handle things better, to not be affected by these things. When you mention resilience, is this what you're talking about?
No, absolutely not. And I think resilience training gets a bit of a bad reputation. This isn't about you've just got to get stronger and deal with this. What this is for me is how do you build the mental capacity and the mental toughness to take back control? Now, if your organization culture is toxic and you're spiraling into this horrible place, then you want to build the mental toughness, the mental resilience to take back control so that you can start considering your next move and your next step. And what I wanted to introduce you today, if it's okay, Denise, is to talk about a specific model that builds what I call human capital, psychological capital. It's actually a positive psychology tool. And it's the capital in your mind that enables you to really take control of the situation that you're in. Does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds complicated.
I probably made it sound more complicated than it is, but I'll talk you through the model. And it's a really simple model to remember. It's called HERO. It's made up of four parts. It's hope, efficacy, resilience, and optimism. And I'll just play each of these out for you. And how about we use the scenario that you shared in the feedback for the situation behavior, the SBI model? So if we were to play this model, hope is a sense of energy to persevere, right? Hope is about your willpower and your way power. So if we think about our willpower, well, I don't want to experience that again. So that my motivation is going to be intrinsic. I don't want to experience that again. My way power is considering what are my options. So with hope, you think about what is it that I want? I don't want to experience that again. And how do I shift it? Well, the way power is I can either contact a central line, I can have a conversation with my boss, I can start looking for a new job. The beauty of hope and the way power element is that there are multiple pathways to the same point. So there is no one right way. And so when you can really build that mental capacity to think, what am I motivated by and how do I do this? You can start to really explore the possibilities that are in front of you. And you stop ruminating, you stop sitting with it, you actually start to take a little bit of control. So that's the hope element of it. The efficacy element of it is having a real confidence in your own ability, having an awareness of your own ability. Now, this is really important because actually, if you are not confident that you have the ability to achieve anything you want in front of you, then you're never going to take that step to move towards it. And actually, with purposeful practice, so when we actually put the time and effort into something, we can achieve anything that we want to if we are motivated to achieve it. And I think I've always got a really good example here. I'm not motivated to play cricket at all. I have no interest in it. I'm not motivated to do it. And so, therefore, I put absolutely no effort into it. I'm really motivated. I'll play a personal example here. I'm really motivated to spend time with my children. Both my children are boys. They love their football. I've never been into football. I'm motivated to learn more about football right now. I wasn't 10 years ago, but I am now. And so I am putting the intentional practice and the intentional learning to understand all these different players, all these different stats. So the confidence in your ability is to know that you can do anything that you put your mind and effort to. That's efficacy. Optimism. Optimism is about seeing a positive future. It's a real nuance to hope, but it's actually being able to see the opportunity with anything that is presented in front of you. There's always learning and there's always an opportunity. And then resilience. Resilience is more than just dealing with what's in front of you. It's actually thinking about the activities that you engage with. Do you sleep well? Do you nurture your body? Are you eating well? All those things that help build the resilience so that when you have stress, when there is conflict, when there is a change in front of you, you are absolutely able to manage it and overcome it. Now, I've just done a lot of talking at you, so I'm going to hit pause and let you come back and share your thoughts.
That is very interesting. I think for a lot of optometrists, it is easy to stay with the same employer or the same company. And having that almost confidence to move away can be challenging. And I was thinking through sort of what you're saying and thinking if I was in a workplace and I wasn't very happy, how this would all apply. And I think the biggest thing is would certainly be the fear of moving. But in the same way that you were saying about football, we're all optometrists. We have the core skills to test sight or to work in hospital or whatever we're doing as optometrists. That's not going to change. That we can take anywhere. And it's about then saying, well, which bit of it do I need to work on? And it's thinking about, well, it's the confidence about approaching other businesses. It's about how to look for another job. They're the bits that you need to work on, not your core skills.
Absolutely. That piece around self-efficacy is knowing your skills and your capability, having confidence in your skills and your capability, but being really intentional about what is it that I need to learn. And so you've just spoken about, you know, what we're talking about here in this whole context is if you're working in a really horrible culture and horrible place, this model will help you build the psychological capital, the mental toughness to be able to take back control. Now, what you're talking about is actually then what do I do with that? So if you look at optometrists, yes, you can do those foundation skills. You'd like to think that everybody has those foundation skills, but each optometrist approaches it in a different way. And that will depend on what their value system is. That will depend on what their strengths are. That will depend on what they're motivated by. And those, if you can get a real understanding of what those are for yourself, then you can absolutely stand in front of somebody else and say, this is my unique selling point. And here's the other thing you can do, which is brilliant as well, is when you get really confident with your value system, when you get really confident with your strengths, then you can start proactively looking at organizations and saying, that is the kind of organization that I want to work for. I'm going to get in touch with them. I'm going to send my CV to them. Now I'm going to share with you that the last two, maybe three jobs that I've got, I have done so because I have sent my CV to organizations that I have wanted to work for because of their value system, because of what they do. And it has given me such confidence and experience to know that I can drive my future. I can drive the career that I want. And that is what I think that the individuals can do when they're experiencing a landscape that is so toxic and not a place for them to be in.
That is really interesting. And I hear what you're saying about values, but how do you begin understanding what your values are?
That's a great question. There's lots of information out there on values, but the place that I started and I still refer back to is the Values in Action survey. If you Google Values in Action, it's part of the positive psychology movement, and it will ask you a series of questions. It's a free online survey. It will ask you a series of questions and it will identify your top values. My top values are around inclusion. So inclusion is hugely important to me. So making sure other people feel included and fairness within that sits with me. So I can absolutely tell when something doesn't feel fair, I feel it in the pit of my stomach, and I know that something is working against my value system. My second value is around curiosity. I'm always really curious. I'm curious to learn about other people. I'm curious to see if there's a better way forward, and I can live true to that. So those are two. And my third one that I'll share is zest. Zest is about positive energy. I really love to have I love a positive working environment. There's something about that that's important to me. And actually, when I left the NHS, I got some feedback from colleagues, and that was one thing they said that they valued in me, was the positive energy that I brought to different meetings and different experiences. So I would say, once you know your value system, then when you're sat in front of somebody, yes, you can talk about your skills, but what's your unique selling point? Well, I'm passionate about inclusion. I'm passionate about practicing curiosity and really understanding things in a different way. And I really, really thrive when I can bring my positive energy somewhere. It's such a unique perspective on who I am that you get to see.
Yeah, and I was just trying to think through what would be true about my values as you were talking. And yes, that fairness and kindness, certainly. And then I was thinking, actually, for me, teaching, so being able to impart wisdom or helping sort of younger, more inexperienced colleagues. And so when I'm sort of thinking about what sort of workplace would I like to work for, it would be where I would be able to have those opportunities.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a lovely way of bringing that to life. And I can really see that in you. And that is absolutely who you are, in helping others, developing others. That comes through in what you do. Now, that comes through in what you do. But if I'm a prospective employer, I won't know that. That's a very unique selling point, I would say. It's your USP. Because actually, if I knew that in the interview, if I knew that was really important to you, then I could already start thinking about where you could help the people in my organization. That's where I think values becomes such a powerful conversation, when you start thinking about how you can apply it to a future career.
Yeah, and of course, it's very obvious when we say it out loud like this, but I guess my default would be, when I was talking to a new employer, was to talk about, well, these are my clinical skills, or this is what I've achieved from a clinical perspective. But like we said before, that is fairly core, but it's those extra little bits to see whether you're going to be the right fit for that team, and therefore hopefully being able to avoid conflict.
Absolutely. And it's also about you identifying if they're right for you. And that's what I want to make sure that individuals do. If this isn't just about an organization interviewing you, you are interviewing them. Are they going to give you the opportunities that you need? If you know that developing others is really important to you, is there space for you to be able to do that? And by bringing this up at the interview, you can ask those questions, because actually you've shared that that's really important to you. So how does that play out in this organization? Inclusion is really important to me. So that's one of the questions I always ask in an organization. What are your priorities around that? How do you help people feel included, especially from there's so many different backgrounds? How do you do that in your organization? And that will help you to identify whether this is the right place for you. But it's not just about values. It's also about strengths. It's also about knowing what your aspirations are. And those and your aspirations, your strengths right now, your future strengths, they can all ebb and flow. They can change. It's being reflective and knowing what your current strengths are, what you'd like your future strengths to be, what your aspirations are, and then building this picture. What is it that I want to do? And then seeking it. Now, you can do that by identifying organizations that hold a similar value system to you, that have those opportunities. That I think there's a central job function, is there?
Yes, the College of Optometrists do have a job board.
Fabulous. So you could start looking at the job board and seeing what sort of jobs are out there. Or perhaps you could start contacting organizations directly. But doing that groundwork in building your mental toughness, or knowing how mentally resilient you actually are as a human, and then getting to understand who you are, is really important to know where you should take your next step.
Yeah, that definitely, there's a lot of food for thought there. So I guess when I'm thinking about our conversation right now, it's it's first of all giving the to see whether you can give the your current situation an opportunity to improve, because it could just be coming from a place of ignorance rather than anything systemic. And maybe the conversations or having meaningful conversations and accepting feedback may be a way to solve it. But then it's having the confidence to say, if it isn't improving, if this workplace is not working for me, if I'm having to give more of myself to this job just to stay, keep your head afloat, it's having the confidence then to walk away.
Absolutely. I think you've nailed that there. So it's, you know, the first step is absolutely make sure you can have the conversation, share the feedback, put the try in, if you, you know, put the effort into trying to make it better if you want to do that. But if not, if you can't see a way forward in this job, then it's taking back control. It's taking back control, and it's about driving the future that you want. Now, I say all this and it all sounds super, super easy because I've just said it in a podcast. But what I would say is that, you know, that maybe it is about investing in getting yourself some coaching. Maybe it is about finding yourself a mentor. Maybe it is about getting into some sort of peer group or peer mentoring group, anything that can access where you can really do this exploration, perhaps in partnership with someone else. That can be really transformative and really help kind of move it forward at a pace that is right for you.
Amazing. And also, if you are really struggling and you need sort of more, I guess, formal support, you can always contact your professional indemnity or your employment advice people, or is there anybody else, Nazia, that would be useful to sort of have in the toolkit?
Absolutely. I would say ACAS are fantastic. They're a central body that you can contact. So I would contact them for sure. And, you know, any speaking up place that you can find where you get to share your experience is really, really powerful. But getting support is a huge step forward, whether that's peer support or whether there is our contact in those central bodies.
Yeah, so making sure you look after yourself and that you're supported, because it is tough. It is tough when you're having to battle this. It is tough when you're trying to sort of change culture or getting the confidence to walk away.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the hardest things that I did. I'm in a much better place having done it. I can look back at that experience and I can still feel the same emotion that I felt when I was in it. But absolutely, it's a hard step to make. It's very worth it. Definitely worth it. And remember, if you build the hope in your mind, there are multiple pathways to the same goal. So if one doesn't work, find another. Absolutely find another pathway that's going to work for you.
Oh, that's brilliant, Nazia. And it's just been so, my mind is now spinning and I'm thinking, right, well, I want to start working on my values. I want to start working on my USP. So to begin my journey of understanding who I am and whether my life is working for me.
Absolutely. Oh, I absolutely think it's the most important thing to you, because you do then live a life that is true to yourself. And you have within your circle, you pull the people that are really, really aligned to your value system as well. It's definitely one I would recommend. A starting point is the values. We haven't spoken about how to understand your strengths. Would it be useful to do that?
Yes, absolutely.
So there's a lovely exercise called Reflected Best Self. You send a question to old colleagues, people that you've worked with before, people that know you really, really well in your personal world, current colleagues, and you ask them to share three examples of you at your best. And when you gather all that in, A, it's going to feel super amazing because you're going to hear all of these wonderful examples about you at your best. But when you read them, you're going to be able to identify themes. So maybe it is that you are really great at communicating. Maybe it is that your compassion comes through in everything that you do. Maybe it is that you are great with the detail. once you start to know what your strengths are, then you're in a position to start saying, and again, this is part of the package, but saying, okay, well, these are my current strengths. What is that I want to get even better at? How could I apply this to my future? And that's probably the best way to understand your strengths. There's lots of tools out there as well that you can pay for, but this is free and it's accessing people that have experienced you. So I think it's a really great way to start.
That sounds like something I kind of want to do, and I'm just trying to think who shall I send it to, because it'll be quite an interesting, I think it'll be a really interesting exercise to see what people say. Well, I mean, Nazia, that was a brilliant conversation we've had today. As I said, there's just so much going through my mind right now. There's quite a lot that I want to be sort of taking on from our conversation forward to see how it will all play out. So thank you so much for coming on iPod today and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been lovely to have this conversation. And I feel energized at the end of this. So I'm really hoping that those that are listening to this feel a little bit more empowered, to make the step forward.
And I'm sure they will. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was a wonderful conversation I had with Nazia this morning, and it has really sort of opened my eyes into knowing that if you are experiencing harassment or bullying, you do not have to put up with it. We are optometrists, we are professionals, we should not be accepting this in our profession. The GOC registrant survey statistics are really worrying, but I am confident that working together with our other sector bodies, we can work to be able to minimise this.